Welcome to the first episode of Daphne 2 Presents The Pod. Today we talk with actor Bjorn Thorstad, who played Shaggy. It's a fun episode, so stay tuned.
Thank you so much for joining me tonight, Bjorn. How are you?
No problem. My pleasure. I'm so happy to be here, Tiger. I'm good, thanks. We're doing all right over here.
You want to start out by introducing yourself for anyone who's not familiar with you?
Sure. So for the, you know, two or three people who don't know who I am, my name's Bjorn Thorstad. I'm an actor in New York City, and I was a part of the inaugural, the first national tour of Scooby-Doo and Stage Fright live on stage, which I think is the occasion for this.
Yes. I'm very excited to hear about this. You know, I was trying to find information online, and you're the only actor I could find that was in the show. Like, I couldn't find a cast list, a full cast list anywhere.
That's hard to believe because there's so many people who are worth mentioning. So that's a shame. There's some real heavy hitters actually, and we can talk about them later. But
yes,
I can't account for that. I don't know why. I don't know why. I looked it up too. It was prepping for the interview. I was like, "How did they get a hold of me?" And and where's the evidence? And apparently there is a note on Wikipedia. So I'm like a footnote in the Scooby-Doo Wikipedia page. I love it.
On the Scooby-Doo Scoobypedia website under cast list, you're the only cast member listed.
Oh, weird. Okay.
Yeah. Well. How did you get this role?
So it was a regular audition. I would say like any other, except that it was for Scooby-Doo. So it was a big, you know, it was a big deal. You're joining this legacy of American, you know, folk television. And at this point it's like 50 years old, right?
So yep, 52. We just had the anniversary a few days ago.
Insane. So my agent called and said, do you do impressions? I was like, yeah, I do a few. He said, can you do the voice of Shaggy? And as a kid, I had, you know, I made a game of imitating various personalities and voices on television and that sort of thing, as a lot of us do. And I tried the Shaggy voice as a kid and I just gave up. I was like, no, I can't do that. That's too hard. But you put a steady paycheck behind it and it changes the equation. So when he asked if I could do the voice of Shaggy, the answer was, of course, yes. Yes, I can.
Anything you need.
And I had 3 days to live up to my promise. So, 3 days later I went in and auditioned and I, sat next to Emily Fletcher, who, was actually auditioning for something else at the time. There was another show down the hall. And Amy Schechter, the casting director, came out, saw Emily, and said, you're here for Scooby-Doo, right? She, no, I'm here for, you know, the musical down the hall, whatever. She said, no, you need to come with me. Because if you look up Emily Fletcher, and your listeners can, you'll see that she, and to this day, looks exactly like Daphne from the cartoon. I mean,
wow.
It's incredible. So,
she ended up being Daphne.
Yeah. So she and I made friends at the callback, which was like an hour or two process. They were pulling us in and pairing us up and, you know, we weren't sure who was going to get it yet. There were a couple of choices for each character waiting out in the hall. And we actually got the call right around 9/11.
Oh, wow.
So it was like September, end of August, early September that we were auditioning, and Emily and I got in touch with each other after the callback, and neither one of us wanted to admit that we got it in case the other one didn't. So we were like, so I forget who was like, who said what, but it was like, did you get it? I don't know. Did you get it? Yeah, me too. Okay, phew, we both got it, but is it going to happen now? Because we, you know, the world was coming to an end.
Right. Nobody was sure what was happening. It happened in New York City at the time, the auditions?
Right, that's right. The auditions were late summer of 2001.
Yeah. So what was the story of this show exactly? Do you remember the storyline?
Yes. So Jim Milan, who was one of the writers, the main writer and the director, got together with a team in Halifax, and they penned out this script that was, you know, that was based on the formula, because every Scooby-Doo show is the same, right?
Yeah, it follows the basic formula, yeah.
Right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So there's like, they followed the exact same formula, and in Scooby-Doo Live on Stage, the conceit is Daphne is going to visit her uncle,
who
is a film director, on the set of his new spooky horror film, which has been plagued by accidents and thefts and mishaps. And so when the gang shows up, he's in a state. The movie is barely holding itself together, and he needs the gang to help them solve the mystery of the missing prop, because one of the props has gone missing, and it's this expensive like set of diamonds that's on loan that the lead actress is supposed to wear, and they're called the Devil's Diamonds, and they've been stolen. So the mystery ensues from there.
What was the monster of the show?
So you think the monster, of course, is the red herring character, Mr. Crawley, who was played by two very talented comedians in our two productions. I did the first and second national tours, and the show went on to have like international legs in the UK a couple times and South America a few times. And my buddy Pierre-Marc DNA, who played Scooby in the first national tour and part of the second national tour, or joined us for the second national, went on to do it like for years after.
Oh, wow.
And blew his knees out. But
he went really in on being the dog.
He did, yeah. So what was the question?
We got so far. Who was the monster?
Who was the monster? Right. So you think it's the red herring character, Mr. Crawley, who was played by Andy Patterson. And Andy's this amazing like talent. He's an incredible classical actor. He was playing, you know, the old Pantalone character from Scooby-Doo. He's like, oh, we're getting away with it, you know? That guy who was like the caretaker. He was like the janitor of the set or whatever. And then in the second half of the first national, a good friend of mine, Dan Fogler, took over. Dan Fogler of the now Harry Potter franchise.
Name sounds familiar.
So he joined us for the second half of the first national as Mr. Crawley, which is a track that was played, you know, where the actor played a bunch of different characters. But so you think it's Mr. Crawley, but it turns out that the Devil's Diamonds were actually stolen by the very actress who wore them in the film and from whom they were stolen. And it was like,
of course,
her and her father, I think. Oh, so it was a red herring. So you think Mr. Crawley did it, and then you realize that the actress stole her own diamonds, but she did it in cahoots with her father, who was Mr. Crawley. So it's
it was a double twist.
Yes, so there was a double twist.
So how many years did you do this show for?
The better part of two. So we started in the late 2001. We did 7 months. We hit like 25 cities in 7 months, with week-long sit-downs in each city, and then we were on hiatus for a bit, a half a year, and then we went on the second national for 4 months, and they dropped us off in Los Angeles. So we wound up just doing a four-month tour the second time around, but we played Radio City, we played the Fox in St. Louis, we played the what was then the Kodak Theater in Los Angeles, and everything in between, all these giant Broadway roadhouses. It was a lot of fun.
That must have been quite a time. You were all over the country.
Yeah.
Did you get to experience the cities?
Definitely. I mean, we got a week in each city, and you know, we were doing quite a bit of press, which got us up at 5 a.m, but our shows weren't until 7 p.m. So we had plenty of time to run around and, you know, see the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, and the we got to see the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Oh. We throw out a couple first pitches here and there at some of the baseball games. And
were you dressed up as Shaggy for those pitches?
I actually let my understudy the swing throw out the first pitch because he was a huge baseball fan and I just am not. So I was like, this is going to mean a lot more to them, you know.
to my Who was your understudy? I'm sorry I interrupted you there.
No, that's all right. A guy named Jeff Statile, a huge baseball fan. He's a doctor now.
Okay. Yeah. Quite a journey.
Yeah. But he's a great guy and a huge baseball fan. So
I can imagine you got close with people.
Very close. In fact, my two Scoobies, Pierre and Dave Droxler, another very talented actor who's now a voice for a bunch of characters on a few Nickelodeon shows.
Okay.
Dave and Pierre and I continue to be really good friends. And actually, Pierre Scooby and Liz Pierce, who was the actress, right? The lead actress who wound up being the villain in the end.
With the diamonds, yep.
Right. They wound up getting married.
Oh, wow. Did they meet on the production?
They met on the production, but we were all on the road and we were 2 or 3 months in when they realized that when Pierre was a kid in London, he was at some international school in London, it's like middle school or high school or something. He went to a production in the West End in which Liz was performing. So he had actually seen her as like a 7-year-old kid in the West End as an audience member watching her on stage. And then they finally met and fell in love on the show. They didn't get together until a year or two later, but maybe it was more than that. Maybe it was a few years, but they eventually did.
Wow, that's quite a lifelong story. Oh, man.
Crazy, right? We just had him over the other night for drinks.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was my next question. Are you still close with these people you worked with?
Very close, very close. Emily Fletcher, who was Daphne, mm-hmm. went on to live her Broadway dreams.
She
played all the, you know, in 42nd Street and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And she did a stint in Moscow, but she was doing, she realized her dreams of being a Broadway baby by the time she was in her late 20s. And she was like, now what? And the answer to that question was to become an industry leader in meditation.
Oh, wow. So
she's got this like international organization that it leads, teaches people how to meditate. And it's like 10 years strong now. And she's written a book and she's spoken in front of Google and she's been on Good Morning America. She's like, she's got a whole new chapter in her life.
Wow, that's quite a Daphne like story right there, you know?
Yeah, right? And the reason I know that is because she wasn't just my Daphne, she's also my guru.
Wow, oh man. So you really got spiritual help from her as well?
Yeah.
Wow, that's so cool. Who was Velma?
So Velma was played by a couple of actors. Randy Rosenholtz was in the second national tour. And Joyce, her name is now Baldwin.
Joyce Baldwin.
That's her name now. She was hilarious. And she was like in the national tour of Greece.
Oh, wow.
Along with Greg Cunin, who was our Fred. Mm-hmm. The two of them did Greece together. So anyway.
Can you do a Shaggy impression for us?
Of course, it's been a while, so you'll have to forgive me. But after doing it every day for the better part of 2 years, what would you like Shaggy to say?
Just give me anything. Well, give me a line from the show.
God, this is like an actor's nightmare because. I don't remember.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
The actor's nightmare is that you're like your show is like reopening like today, and you have to the role that you did 20 years ago, and you have no idea.
Tell me a good zoinks.
What were the lines? Zoinks! Look out, Scoob!
Oh, wow!
What I wouldn't give for a ham sandwich.
That is spot on. Did you have a particular Shaggy you took inspiration from?
Definitely. Obviously, Casey Kasem is the OG.
Right.
So if you're not centering your vocal performance around Casey Kasem's characterization, you're not really doing yourself any favors, because uh-huh. that's the expectation, right? Like, everybody who came after is standing on the shoulder of that giant, you know? So whether it was me or Matthew Lillard or Scott Innes or, you know, any of the other the handful of guys who've done it, it's kind of, it's signature, and it's so expected mm-hmm. that if you deviate, it's gonna be a disappointment, I think. So yeah. it was a real, that was one of the demands of the job, you know? The other demand being, it's a cartoon and you've gotta recreate it in a live format. So how do you defy the laws of physics, or seem to anyway, right? Because that's another, where they do that thing where they like jump up in the air and they they run for like 3 seconds without going anywhere, and then they
did you do that in the play?
Well, that was like the spirit of the physicality that I wanted to capture. So it was all about like, how do you, you know, the problem was, how do you can't like jump up in the air,
right?
So how do you make it look like, how do you make it feel like you're doing that? And so all of the physicality, all of the running around was never going to get to that point, but that was always the
energy,
always the vision and the energy. Yeah, exactly.
So what were rehearsals like on this?
For the first national, we were making it up as we went along. I mean, Jim and the writing team had planned out some jokes and some physical bits, mm-hmm. but the mechanics of how they were going to work were not all realized on the page necessarily, and nor need they have been. Mm-hmm. So they would send us off into the separate room, you know, me and Pierre, and we would work with a movement coach, this amazing choreographer, Jen Rapp, and we came up with a lot of the bits and just sort of figured out how they were going to work. Like, what are the demands of gravity when the problem is Scooby has to leap into your arms while you're doing a pirouette, you know? So how do you make that work? And if you can't make the joke on the page work, what do you do instead? So there was a lot of like creative problem solving and improvisation.
That's really interesting. Like, you really had to develop the play while you were rehearsing.
Very much so, yeah. I'm, you know, not too many of the lines needed to change, but mm-hmm. But a lot of the bits did. A lot of them had to be cut. Some of them had to be changed, you know, and for better and for worse. Like, if we were spending 2 hours trying to get a sandwich to blow in the wind, and it was just taking up too much time, you know, to get all the parts to come together. It was like a ballet where the actors and the set had to work together. Mm-hmm. And we had one scene that was literally called the door ballet, where we had a one-ton door drop that came down with six doors, and it was that classic French farce, you know.
Okay, yeah.
People, they're running in and out of one door. Running
out one the door. Doorway gag. Oh, I'm so happy you guys had that.
Absolutely. And then at one point, Scooby's head appears around the corner of one door, way over on stage left, you know, and then 50 yards stage right, his tail pokes out the door on the other end of the stage, and they're like,
oh, that's so cool.
So yeah, it was a lot of choreography, and 60% of the choreography was backstage and just trying to get the mechanics of it right. But it was so much fun. It was so rigorous. It was such an incredible workout. It was like 90 minutes of yoga on crack. It was wow. So physical. We would come off stage and we'd be absolutely dripping in sweat, and you know,
I can imagine Pierre especially.
Oh, yeah, I was just about to say, Pierre's in like three layers of unitard, right? One of them is like a bodysuit, and then over that is sculpted beautiful sculpted foam by Yvette Studios, who did The Lion King, and then over that is this this layer of felt. So he looked beautiful, but then the kids would like run down the aisle to try to you know, pet him. Put a hand in a pool of sweat. It would just be
oh
like,
oh my God. Wow. So did you actually catch him? Was there actually a part where you had to catch him?
Yes, yes. I mean, we had to catch each other repeatedly. It was just nothing. It was constantly scrambling up and down each other, ducking under tables, around corners, running and screaming. I mean, it was just, it was insane. I was in the best shape of my life. it was crazy.
Becoming a cartoon, very physical. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a classic Scooby gag where Daphne holds the entire gang. Did anything like that happen?
No, that would have been amazing, though. No. That would have been amazing, but that probably would have taken the whole budget of the show to like work.
So did you have any other roles in the production of the show besides Shaggy?
Yeah, I mean, doing all the press, like being the face of the press. Originally, they were planning on having the press duties divided equally among the cast. You know, they didn't want to have to overburden any one cast member. But, you know, everybody's favorites are Shaggy and Scooby. And, you know, everybody wants to see the dog. And if you have the dog, you have to have the man. And so, and we just got good at it. I mean, we got good at, like, playing around with the newscasters and, you know, the radio personalities. And I suppose the voices of Shaggy and Scooby are the most distinct of the of the gang, and so to hearing them on, they play better on radio. So Pierre and I, and Amir Arison, who voiced Scooby, along with Clayton Dean Smith, they took turns voicing Scooby. Wound up doing a lot of the press. And yeah, because Scooby was voiced by another actor off stage.
I didn't even realize. That's hilarious.
I take that for granted, but that's always sort of a novel thing for people to find out, because they assume that the voice is coming from the same actor in the suit, and it's not. The actor in the suit is just a puppeteer. Mm-hmm. But so the role was being the press guy, and you know, we'd go and do these interviews all day, and so they
you'd
had to
be in character.
In character, yeah.
Wow.
So, but it was fun. We had fun with it. It was like morning at the Improv. You know, one of the shows, we were in Salt Lake City and we did this show called Good Things Utah. And it's like the 6 a.m. Good Morning, you know, local Good Morning
show. Oh, man.
Like a cooking segment or whatever. And they'd throw Shaggy and Scooby into the mix. You know, it's like jambalaya with Shaggy and Scooby.
Oh, I would love to see that. Oh, my goodness.
I'm sure there's a clip of it somewhere.
Oh, I'm gonna find it if there is.
Unfortunately, it's probably on VHS, so you'll have to convert it.
Ah. So, was there any big food gags? Like, what food did you have to eat as Shaggy?
There was a buffet table in one scene. Of course, there's always got to be a food gag. There was a plate of spaghetti that was like a mountain. And then we would grab either ends of it, Scooby and I, and we would slurp the spaghetti until the mound would slowly sink and sink and sink until it was flat.
Okay.
And what else was there? There was a big pot of like something with dry ice in it. And what was one of the, we had that sandwich gag. I really wish we could have got that to work. It was, we're like riding up in the back of the Mystery Machine. The Mystery Machine had like a sunroof in it. Our Mystery Machine did. It had a sunroof. And so we were standing up, and they actually had a vintage 1969 Dodge van that they cut in half, and they took about a foot or two out of it to shorten it on stage, and then took the gas engine out, put an electric engine in, and they drove the thing around on stage. It was an actual,
oh, wow.
It was an actual vintage van from the period.
That sounds like a big thing. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was insane. And then we were supposed to be trying to eat this many layered sandwich in the back of the van, but because we were standing up and it was outside, the wind was blowing the sandwich layer, so a slice of cheese would fly, and then a ham, and then a
okay,
and then an olive or whatever, but we couldn't and the way it was supposed to work was on a fishing line, and there was somebody off stage who was like trying to reel the sandwich. We spent so much rehearsal time trying to get it to work that eventually we just had to let it go, but it would have been a cool bit.
So there were no sandwiches in the final show?
There were sandwiches, but I think we were like going to take a bite of one, and then the specter came up, the spooky specter came up behind us and scared us before we got a chance to or something. It was...
So what was it like working with the director, Jim? What's he like?
Great. Jim is great. You know, he comes from the Kids in the Hall. Mm-hmm. He's their the director for all their tours. And so he's a comedy scientist. And working with somebody who thinks like a scientist and is precision oriented when it comes to comedy and takes comedy very seriously was my jam. I mean, I grew up loving the Kids in the Hall. There was
That's a classic.
There was a VHS tape of a bunch of different episodes that made its way around my entire high school class. And my best friends and I would just watch it over and over and over again. So, you know, getting to work with Jim and Mark McKinney, who was a story editor on Scooby-Doo, was like a dream come true. I mean, it didn't get any better than that for me. So like it wasn't just doing like this silly cartoon show for me. It was like, you know, it was realizing a childhood or a young dream of mine very early on.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah.
And Jim was, I mean, Jim's great. He's a comic genius. He's super relaxed and groovy. He's super chill. He's very punk rock. Like when he was doing theater in Toronto, he was like, you know, very rebellious. So he had this countercultural edge to him that was very appealing to a young 20-something cast of actors. And and he's just a super decent, awesome guy.
That's cool. That's good. Seems like you got to work with a lot of good people.
Yeah. I did. So, and it was all about the people. Yeah, it was all about the people. Incredible people. Started from the top down.
Do you have any more stories from rehearsals or from the road that you want to share?
There was a story that I was not allowed to tell.
Oh.
According to general management. I told it, I mentioned it to one reporter who was doing like, you know, before the pre-press or whatever, before the press before the show comes into town, they were doing advanced press, that's what I meant. And I got in trouble for telling this story, but I don't suppose it matters anymore because I'm not representing Warner Brothers.
20 years later.
Or Clear Channel, or I'm not, you know, like for the record, I'm not affiliated anymore, so I think I might be off the hook. But we had this amazing props mistress, Anne Marie Rodeba, I think is her last name. And she was just like this awesome, like super cool technician who wound up making it like the spaghetti thing. She was the one who operated the spaghetti under the table. She made, and I think she solved a lot of those props problems. So she was
complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. She had a big job and she was just awesome. But one night, I want to say it was at the Wang Center in Boston. She cut a fart under the table that we had to subsequently dive under. And it was so unbelievably stinky that when I got out other side of the table to like, you go under the table and then you poke your head out from underneath the table mat or the place, whatever, the tablecloth. I forgot my line. I was so traumatized by the smell. I was like, oh my God, what do I say next? And I peek my head back under the tablecloth and I look at her and she's got this shit-eating grin on her face.
That's so funny.
And I can't remember my line, but I'm like, I'm mic'd, and the microphone picked up the fart. Like people heard it and they're laughing, and I don't know if they're laughing because I'm laughing,
right?
They're laughing because they heard the fart. But the next line, and I couldn't believe this. I was like, I can't believe this. I forgot my line. And the next line, which is supposed to be in reference to the big pot of, you know, whatever's bubbling at the other end of the table, is, would you smell that?
Oh, the irony. So that show, that joke was funnier than any other show.
It was meant to be. Yes, that joke was like clearly of the gods. Like the gods had ordained that that joke had to be in.
Wow.
But I got her back a couple weeks later, I think. Where we were like, or Cleveland or wherever we were, like, I got her back. I was under the table.
Oh no.
and I was holding one in, I let it rip under there to
That is actually such a Scooby and Shaggy moment. They're always, it's kind of gross, but they're always making fart jokes, you know?
So can we talk, is it okay for me to ask you questions?
Yeah, of course, please.
Tiger, where does your love of Scooby come from?
Oh man, it's deep. The community, I think, is what really keeps me in love with Scooby-Doo. Like, I love Scooby-Doo as a kid, right? And I sort of fell off when I was maybe 10 or 12 years old. And as a teenager, I discovered this website, ScoobyAddicts.com. It had a forum with a bunch of people that all love Scooby-Doo. And I sort of was like, wait, Scooby-Doo's still happening? So at the time as a teenager, I got back into Scooby-Doo through this website. And then now, you know, 10 years later, as an adult, Instagram has a huge Scooby community. So once I discovered all the people on there, I got back into Scooby-Doo. I'm like, okay, it's still going again. You know, every time I'm like surprised a little bit because I fall off for a long time. So then it's always the community that brings me back because it's such a huge, diverse group of people from all walks of life, all over the world. It's really insane how worldwide the Scooby fandom is. It's beautiful.
It's incredible, isn't it? The community is incredible, but what about the show do you think inspired the initial draw? Like, why do you think people are so drawn to Scooby? Is it because, it can't just be because other people are drawn to it, can it? That's a huge part of it, because it does sort of bring it has a great demographic. Like, you have to be, you know, a good-hearted person, I think, to be into Scooby-Doo and passionate about it. So, but what do you think it is about the series itself?
I think, yeah, that's a good point. It's a good-hearted show. You know, the characters in it have good hearts. Each one is different enough that somebody could find a character in the show that they relate to. Like, the characters are sort of blank slates in a way, even though they have their own personalities. They're just generic enough for somebody could feel like Fred, somebody could feel like Daphne, or like I could feel like Shaggy, you know? You find a character you love and you get attached to them, and there's so much of them, and everything is 52 years. Their personalities are very consistent. So it's like having a friend who you can always count on. You could always count on Scooby-Doo to be a good dog and to make you laugh and to have a wholesome show. And it's a little predictable, like the most recent series, Scooby-Doo and Guess Who, you know, it very much follows the formula every episode to a T, and it's getting predictable, but it's still fun. Even after 52 years, it's still enjoyable. Even though, like, you know, there's gonna be the door gag every episode or something, it's still fun to see 52 years later.
It'd be weird if it weren't predictable, right? I mean, that's got to be part of the success, because look at shows like, you know, all the Dick Wolf properties, like SVU, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, SVU is like, what are they, in their 23rd season now?
Right. And
every show is the same formula. I mean, it's a different...
Exactly. It's about having that formula.
It's a different current event they tackle, and the writing is incredible, but the formula has got to be key to the success.
Right.
And I'm maybe that's a subject for another episode. Like, what's
that perfect formula that Scooby?
What is it about the formula that keeps us coming back?
Mm-hmm. As you said before, like, even when they were writing the play, they followed that exact formula and had to adapt it to stage. Even 20 years ago, when the show was only 30 years old, it's still, the formula has been established for a long time.
So not a lot of people know this. Some of the dorkier, nerdier folks will, but I think it's worth mentioning, and it's definitely my way into Scooby-Doo, because I was not always a fan.
Okay.
Like, as a kid, I was like, I watched it, but I wasn't like, I preferred other cartoons. But do you know Eddie Izzard and his?
I love Eddie Izzard. The Riches is one of my all-time favorite TV series. I'm still mad at FX for canceling it.
Right? I know. Like, great series. Have you seen Dressed to Kill?
Of course, yeah.
So you remember his little segment in Dressed to Kill about Scooby and Shaggy, right?
I can't say I remember. I was probably 13 years old the last time I watched it.
There's a YouTube clip of Eddie, okay. And it's him talking about the appeal of Shaggy and Scooby and how there are... You know, they're cowards who are always hungry and eating. And he's like, they're loved the world over. And what is it about them? And he said, well, what other characters from literature do we know who are like that? He says Falstaff from Shakespeare and a character from James Joyce. And he's like, so it's like Shaggy and Scooby is like that level of greatness. You know, he's like,
he's tracing the lineage of their character traits. That's really interesting.
Yes, but it goes back even further than Eddie mentions to Commedia dell'arte.
Okay.
So when I started studying the cartoons for the audition, mm-hmm. I was like, you know, how do they stand? How do they walk? How do they carry? How do you know? It's like, oh my God, they're standing in the first position. They're doing these ballet moves. They're doing these sort of classical, like Fred and Daphne lead with the chest and Shaggy and Scooby, you know, they have these, you know, sort of floppy zanny move. So it turns out that every one of the characters on Scooby-Doo are based on Commedia dell'arte characters, right? You've got Daphne and Fred, who are the lovers, right? The ingenues. And you've got Velma, who's il dottore. She's like the, you know, the pedant, the studious and intelligent one. And then you've got Shaggy and Scooby, who are the zanny characters, who are always getting the best of their masters, right? And they're always either hungry or scared, or they've got some, you know, fatal flaw that makes them super hilarious. And then the bad guys are always the pantalone characters, the old men with the big nose and the... Right. So they're like, they're drawn right out of this Italian tradition from the 15th to 18th centuries that, you know, the through line for which you can trace through vaudeville, through sitcoms, through cartoons. So when I realized that I wasn't just doing a silly cartoon, it was actually returning a comedic tradition back to the medium where it began. It had this-
It makes so much sense, yeah.
Lovely full circle aspect to it that was just too exciting to resist.
Did your cast members share that sentiment at the time?
I don't know. I don't think I ever talked about it. Okay. That was my own private little bit of, you know, I would have lost friends if I tried to talk to
too nerdy for the rest of the
like, you're a nerd. Get out of here. We're like, we're just doing a show. Shut up and have fun.
What got you into acting?
My elementary school friend, Seth, who lived up the street from me, asked me if I wanted to audition for the show that his dad was directing in downtown Aurora, Colorado. Mm-hmm. At this old Army Munitions factory. It was Army Munitions Warehouse that had been converted into a theater in the mid-century. And then converted from a theater, from a movie theater into a live theater. So it was called the Aurora Fox Art Center. His dad was directing Oliver Twist, a play version of Oliver. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I was like 9 years old. I said, sure, I'll go do that with my dad. And then it became like an activity, after school activity like any other, you know, and go to soccer practice, baseball practice, and then play practice, and play practice was the thing that kind of stuck.
So you just went on from there. You stayed stuck with acting?
Yeah, I started when I was 9 and I never stopped. I just kept doing it. Locally in the community theater, semi-professional theaters of the Denver metro area. And then when I was 16, I got an agent, started taking it seriously in high school, and then told my parents, broke the news to my parents really that I wanted to major in it in college. They were like, what if you minored in it instead? And I was like, no.
Right, they're like, is that a major?
Yeah. So God bless them. They paid for a conservatory education.
Wow.
And
that's very unique.
Yeah, it's like, it's super, super privileged. Like, it has been a bit of a problem that, like, the only people who wind up getting to be actors are sort of filtered through this very expensive system, that kind of rules out the possibility of others. And there are people who come through the cracks, slip through the cracks. Like, for instance, T.R. Knight, who was a series regular on on Grey's Anatomy, never went to a performing school or whatever, but obviously it didn't matter. Now he's a huge movie star. But the system by and large has been very, like, exclusive and a bit out of reach to people who couldn't afford these sort of, you know, elite BFA and MFA programs. I think that might be changing now. I mean, the Yale School of Drama which is now the David Geffen School of Drama, is now free to MFA students and others, because David Geffen gave this huge gift. So he's paying basically everybody's tuition. So there's a move to, like, balance that inequity. But it's something that I've realized lately. I was like, oh my God, I just took for granted this huge privilege that not a lot of people got to enjoy.
Well, that's good that you're aware of your privilege. At least that's the first step.
Right. Awareness, right, is the first step, right?
Yeah. So what acting school did you go to?
Boston University.
Okay.
They have an arts school there where they have, like, a sculpture program, visual arts, and opera program called the College of Fine Arts.
What brought you to New York?
It was a choice between New York and Chicago. I wanted to do theater. And theater in Chicago had a great reputation, and theater in New York is where you go when you go all the way. So I decided to go to the city, even though it was scarier in New York. I decided to go to the city where you could go all the way.
What was your first big production?
That was it.
Really?
Yeah, Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo was my big break.
My first professional contract out of
Wow. Where'd you go after Scooby-Doo?
Into the regions. So there's this, like, circuit of regional theaters around the country that still do a classical repertoire, Molière and Shakespeare, and then they tend to mix their seasons with more contemporary plays, things that have appeared on and off Broadway the season before. They'll do out in the regional theaters. It's called the LORT theaters, League of Regional Theaters, around the country, that most Class A, B, and C cities have them.
What are some recent projects or upcoming projects you've got?
So I took it, I mean, everybody's taken time off from theater because of COVID.
Right.
And I actually stepped away from theater 4 years ago to focus on television, but I have been traveling lately, and
that's nice.
And yeah, and that's had most of my attention. What the hell did I do recently? last thing I did was 3 seasons at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival.
Okay.
But then, you know, everything shut down because of COVID, so. Mm-hmm. Where theater is just now getting back into the swing of things.
What TV have you done?
I was a recurring character on Law and Order SVU.
Okay.
I had a part in an episode of The Nick.
Oh, I like that show. I gotta look out for you.
it's episode 6. It was crazy because Steven Soderbergh was, like, holding the camera, like, crouched down in the corner, like, right over my left shoulder. And I had researched for that role months in advance because I was like, oh my God, I worked with Steven Soderbergh, I've got to, like, know my shit. Character was a memento mori photographer. And back in the early part of the 20th century, it was not uncommon for people to take pictures of their loved ones posthumously right after they died. And that's actually a trend that's coming back lately since the aughts, the early aughts. But it went away after, you know, around the time of the Titanic. It ceased to be fashionable. And it stayed unfashionable for decades. And then now it made this resurgence. But I was like, what the hell is, like, who, like, there was a guy who's like a memento mori photographer where you go into hospitals and you take pictures of dead children. And there's this whole, like, cottage industry of that.
Wow.
And
the things you don't expect people to, you know, have.
The things you learn as an actor, like, there's just, it's the best education, because you have no idea what's going on in the world until you have to play a role, and then you know everything about it. But there happened to be this museum gallery exhibit of memento mori photography from the early part of the 20th century.
Checked
that out, and I actually got a hold of a memento mori photographer in Boston. She was the area coordinator for memento mori photographers in the greater Boston area. So she would, like, pair photographers with a hospital, say, or a grieving family, and I was like, walk me through your day, like, what you know, from the moment you step foot in the door, what is going on for you? Because, like, how do you even begin to imagine what it's like to be a memento mori photographer
without a unique, like, you gotta look at dead bodies all the time. I can't even imagine.
Right. And it's gotta be normal, and it's got to be, like, you know, it's got to be normal, it's got to be routine for you. So by the time I got on set, I was like, I knew more about what was going on in that moment than anybody, because it was a scene about you know, a dead baby being photographed, and, like, so, like, I don't know who else researched that, but the guy who's playing the father was like, should I look at the camera, do I look at you? And I knew the answers to those questions, because I looked at enough pictures. I was like, oh, well, actually,
you had all their answers.
Soderbergh, if I may.
They were like, shut up.
Yeah.
So besides acting and Scooby-Doo, do you have any other passions or hobbies?
I play the piano privately. Nobody's ever heard that. Maybe three or four people. And I study languages. So I work regularly with a French and Polish tutor.
Oh, that's interesting. It's fun to, you know lots of languages. I'm always trying to learn Japanese. I'm still trying to learn after 10 years.
Yeah. What got you into Japanese?
You know, I guess I'm a nerd too, you know, anime, video games, lots of video games only released in Japanese I would love to be able to play, but.
Oh, nice. Okay.
It's going to be a long time.
are you Duolingoing, or what's your.
I'd say every year I do a good month straight of Duolingo, and then I fall off and I have to restart, you know, or Memrise. I find Memrise to be very effective. But better my problem than Duo? Is I fall off and I have to restart every time, you know?
Something's got to stick though, like, right? Like, you don't forget everything, do you?
I do, honestly. Everything. I'm bad. I can read Korean, but I can't tell you what it's saying. I remember the alphabet. I've done enough times.
So you know how to pronounce it, but you don't know what it means?
Yeah, exactly.
That's so,
cool. Yeah, you know, I got my own problems there.
it's like a habit, right? Like, if you, it's like going to the gym. It's easy to fall off the bandwagon, but.
Right. But when you're on it, you're on it, you know?
Yeah. But a worthy pursuit.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. You're into languages. How, are you fluent in them?
Not in Polish, but I'm almost fluent in French. I mean, I can carry on a conversation and I could live in France and within 2 weeks I'd be fluent, but I need the immersion component.
Mm-hmm.
When I lived there for even just a week, I had studied for 6 years and I started to dream in French after about day 10.
Wow.
So that's when I knew, but But so really the tutoring is just to sort is upkeep.
Fair. I would need to keep yourself from losing it.
Yeah, I would need to go and actually immerse and have a reason to speak every day. And that would be, I think, I would achieve fluency in French pretty quickly, but Polish would take a while longer. I only started Polish 2 years ago.
Okay, interesting. What got you to do Polish? I'm sorry we're going so off topic, but it's interesting. Yeah.
Love.
Nice. Simple. Love it.
I fell for a Polish national.
Ah, nice. That's beautiful. So, do you have a favorite Scooby-Doo series?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. I haven't actually seen, besides the original vintage cartoons, I haven't actually seen a full episode of any of the more recent ones. And I don't think I've seen any of the movies all the way through either.
Oh, wow.
I remember watching part of the original Scooby-Doo live actions with, you know, who was in it? It was like Freddie Prinze Jr. and Matthew Lillard,
yeah.
Who played Velma? Gosh, a wonderful actress who's...
Linda Cardellini,
who's had an incredible career. She was great. So, but I kind of wanted to see, I was like, oh, how does it translate to live action? I just wanted to see. And I was curious how Matt was going to play the role.
You were before them, right? Because the movie came out in 2002. So you were technically the first live action Shaggy, which is really interesting.
Gosh, now that you mentioned it, I might actually be.
Yeah.
Well, that's crazy. That's a fun distinction.
Right. Yeah, that's... You get to keep that title forever.
Right. Nobody can take that from me.
So, did you watch a lot of Scooby-Doo coming up to the play, preparing for the role or anything?
Yes. Oh, yeah. A ton of Scooby. Yes. Watched the cartoons religiously and studied all the movements because I needed a vocabulary of physicality. So, wanted to get, you know, a dozen or so recognizable physical gestures, recognizable traits, the classic walk, the slouch. It's like, how do the arms move? Like, and it became, you know, Shaggy was my Hamlet. So I was like, I couldn't go too deep.
Mm-hmm. You became Shaggy, but you couldn't become Shaggy.
I don't know. I think there was a bit of a meld. Mm-hmm. I think Shaggy became me and I became Shaggy.
Do you feel like it's left a lasting impact on you being Shaggy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It was a graduate education in comedy and it was a graduate education in Commedia dell'arte, frankly. I mean, it was like, and an education in performing in venues that size. Like we rehearsed for months in Times Square in a big, big studio. And so we calibrated our performances for the size of the studio. But then when we opened in Louisville, all of a sudden there are 2,000 people and the space is like 10 times as big. And so the performance that you'd calibrated for the studio now has to play this grand hall. And I was mortified within the first scene or two of the first previews in Louisville to find that my performance was not sufficient. It was just not making the cut. It wasn't hitting the back row. It was barely holding the attention of people beyond rows 15 and 16. You know what I mean? Like you can tell when you have them and we didn't have them. And it was just the sheer size of the theater and the
wow.
2,000 seats was like the smallest houses we were playing. Maybe 1,200 was the smallest, but we were playing upwards of 3,000-4,000 seats. Radio City's a 6,000 seat house.
Wow. And they were packed.
And we were at 70% capacity or better. Wow. So all of a sudden, you, well, what do I do? I'm in the middle of a show and my performance is inadequate, mm-hmm. and I've been rehearsing for this for a month, and this is all I have. So we just had to adjust on the fly. We just had to go, oh, well, we have, you know, and I think there were a couple conversations in the wings mm-hmm. right after the first scene. It's like, it's not working. But that was two cities before Radio City, right?
Which we went the Louisville biggest one.
That we went Louisville, Atlanta, and then I think we went to New York. So New York was like a third. We wanted to open in a couple different places before we played the big time. By the time we got to New York, we had figured it out. And then all of a sudden, so like a gesture like this, you know, in Louisville became this.
It had to be a lot bigger.
To hit the back row. It had to hit the back row. It was just, yeah. They were fun problems to solve. You know, how do you calibrate to the different size space? But that's the joy of live performance. You know that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me on today's show. It's really been an honor to have you here.
Thanks for the trip down memory lane.
What's your website and @ so everybody can find you?
It's my name, Bjorn Thorstad. So if you Google me, everything comes up.
All right.
The Instagram. Thanks a lot, Tiger. I gotta go and check out the ScoobyAddicts.com. Is the podcast a part of that, or are they not affiliated?
I'd say I'm close friends with her now. Nikki runs ScoobyAddicts.com. She's been on a few episodes of my show. If you check back my 1 year anniversary special, I had her on, and we also did a live Q&A interview a while back.
Oh, awesome.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. You're really awesome.
So nice to meet you. That goes both ways. I feel like I got to ask you though, before we go, like which of the characters, which of the gang did you identify with most?
I'm Shaggy. Yeah.
I feel like you were going to say that.
I'm the stereotypical stoner Shaggy, you know?
Awesome. Awesome. Me too, man. Me too at heart.
Hey, it's really a pleasure to meet you, brother. Thank you so Likewise. Much for coming on today.
Likewise, Tiger.
Have a good night. Thank you for joining Daphne 2 Presents. Oh, could you give me a Daphne 2 Presents in the Shaggy voice?
Like, thanks for joining Daphne 2 Presents.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the inaugural episode of Daphne 2 Presents The Pod. I want to once again thank Bjorn Thorstad for coming on the episode and give a shout out to Richard the Red for providing the background music and @ Scooby News on Instagram for providing the poster cover art. Make sure you check them both out. This has been your host, Tiger Singh. Tune in every Friday for a new episode of Daphne 2 Presents The Pod, and follow Scooby-Doo Daphne 2 on Instagram for daily Scooby-Doo content and live Q&As. Have a great day.
I've been having bad dreams. Now I can't seem to fall asleep at night. Oh, how could you be so mean? What a fantasy. I've been having bad dreams.